One of the defining issues of the past decade has been how to balance our core civil liberties with the desire to keep us safe from terrorist attacks. And that's something we discussed with Nadine Strossen 10 years ago when she was the president of the American Civil Liberties Union. She's currently a professor of constitutional law at the New York Law School, and I'm very pleased to welcome her back to our program.
So good to be back, Leonard.
Do you think our civil liberties have changed much since September 10th, 2001?
Unfortunately, the answer to that is yes, and not in ways that are proportionate to the increases in security, if any, that we've attained since then. For those who would like an overview, a very sobering, interesting, thoughtful overview, I commend an ACLU report that was issued yesterday entitled A Call to Courage, Reclaiming Our Liberties 10 Years After 9/11. As the name suggests, Leonard, what we've been suffering from in the past 10 years has been an exaggerated politics of fear. Of course, the 9/11 attacks were a disaster. Those of us who are located in Lower Manhattan, including the ACLU's own national headquarters, which was shut down and communications were destroyed, and we saw the militarization, we lost loved ones. We certainly have no desire to perpetuate the danger of terrorism. And yet, the question is, what measures are actually necessary and effective to actually increase national security?
And we will put a link to that report on our show page at WNYC.org. As I said earlier, you were on our program not long after the attacks in late September 2001. Let's listen to something you said. You said this about how we should proceed.
Let's go slow. Let's at least proceed with a full discussion as to what power the government already has, and it already has enormous power to engage in surveillance, including electronic surveillance and wiretapping.
But you don't think we went all that slowly?
Not at all. In fact, Melissa Egan, your producer, reminded me that the date of that interview, of which you just played a clip, happened to be September 20th, 2001. And that's an extraordinary coincidence, Leonard, because on that very date, an amazingly diverse coalition of organizations completely across the ideological spectrum, from right to left, came together to issue principles in defense of freedom at a time of crisis. And these groups included not only the ACLU, organizations that are considered to the left of the spectrum, such as People for the American Way, Common Cause, Americans for Democratic Action, but also really arch-conservative groups, the American Conservative Union, Phyllis Schlafly's Eagle Forum, the gun owners' rights organizations, and one of the principals. And I remember Margot Adler of WNYC said, Nadine, how could you get even two of these groups to agree on even one of these principles, but we agreed on 10 principles, and one of them was we need to consider proposals calmly and deliberately with a determination not to erode the liberties and freedoms that are at the core of the American way of life. And yet, just a couple of weeks later, Congress rushed through and the president signed, with almost no hearings, almost no debate, the USA Patriot Act, which was 350 pages long, which amended a dozen major federal laws, which included 160 provisions. And most members of Congress admitted that they hadn't even read it. It wasn't until a year later that Congress put together commissions, plus we had a bipartisan commission, to study what were the actual causes of the disaster on 9/11. If you don't know what the cause is, how can you possibly come up with a rational solution?
But when the Patriot Act came up for renewal, pretty much everyone in Congress voted to renew it.
And that is one of the very scary things about the particular cutbacks on liberty that we've had since 9/11, Leonard. In one sense, you can say, well, every time there's a national security crisis or even a fear of a threat to national security, our country, along with countries around the world, will rush to sacrifice civil liberties unnecessarily. We've seen that pattern over and over again.
And many Americans, I remember, said, I'm happy to give up some of those rights. I'm happy because in the end, it's for the good of the country.
Exactly. Now, the difference this time around, though, is unlike World War II, where we had the travesty of interning 120,000 Japanese Americans, including citizens, thank goodness we have had nothing of that magnitude this time around. But that was accomplished by an executive order. During the McCarthy era, we had a congressional committee that was engaging in violation of people's liberty and privacy. And yet a congressional committee goes out of existence, an executive order can be abolished by one stroke of the pen. The difference this time around is twofold. We have not only the Patriot Act, but many other pieces of legislation that have concretized violations of civil liberties. And once Congress has done that, once it's put it on paper, it is almost impossible to get Congress to roll it back.
Although the courts can have a say, but we'll get to that in a moment. My guest is Nadine Strossen, who is the former president of the American Civil Liberties Union. She's currently a professor of constitutional law at New York Law School. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Ludit Lopate. Recently, the Associated Press reported on New York Police Department domestic intelligence operations that were done in coordination with the CIA that involved spying on the Muslim community here in New York. And I thought the CIA was banned from collecting information on Americans.
There used to be, prior to 9/11, a basic divide between international and foreign domestic intelligence gathering, which gave the CIA more power to engage in surveillance over suspected foreign terrorists or spies, with less limits on their power, with less judicial or congressional oversight, as distinguished from domestic criminal-type investigations. That line has been blurred enormously, and we have not only the CIA, but also military officials are engaging in surveillance of Americans simply for exercising our protected First Amendment rights, political dissidents and protesters, activists,
but also,
and members of minority religions.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of talk about profiling during this period. Was there a similar look into organizations that Timothy McVeigh might have been connected to, or have we been a little harder on the Muslim community?
There is no doubt that the profiling has consistently targeted, starting with September 11th itself, young immigrant Muslim men from the Middle East and South Asia. It started with what the Inspector General of the Justice Department itself in the Bush 1 administration called an indiscriminate and arbitrary sweep of people in this category who are held incommunicado in prisons, especially in New York and New Jersey, and not a single one was ever charged with a single terrorist offense. They were engaged in, some of them were charged with low-level immigration violations, and I certainly don't condone them, but that is not the way you treat people who have overstayed their student visas, throwing them into prison and denying them communication with their family and lawyers. And that pattern has continued. But what I think is really important to stress, Leonard, is that it is not only Muslims and other, immigrants who have been targeted. But I think most people are unaware of the extent to which every single person in this country, white males, radio journalists, law professors, every single one of us is significantly less free today. Less freedom of speech, less access to government information, unwarranted government secrecy, less privacy, government spying on our communications, our associations, our beliefs, in the name of national security, but not actually increasing national security.
I want to still stick with the profiling for just one more moment. That report that I mentioned also says that the NYPD sought things like a rundown of every Pakistani cab driver in the city, which comes as a bit of a shock. But maybe the whole world has gotten slightly changed as a result. Last night at the Republican debate, Texas Governor Rick Perry endorsed deploying Predator drones along the U.S.-Mexican border. That's something that would have been unheard of 15 years ago.
And again, we have to come back to this basic question that the ACLU and our ideologically diverse colleagues asked 10 years ago, and that is, are these measures even effective in increasing national security? I mean, I personally don't believe that the end justifies the means, but if the means doesn't even promote the end of national security, then it's even less justified. And no less an important and respected person than New York Police Commissioner Ray Kelly has spoken very forcefully and persuasively based on his own experience that profiling is ineffective and counterproductive because by definition it is overly broad, it sweeps in too many innocent people, and it doesn't hone in on the dangerous ones who are identified not by who they are but by behavioral characteristics. And I thought it was very chilling that the NYPD program was called the demographic unit, and that, as I understand it, is completely contrary to what Ray Kelly has attested to based on his prior experience with the Treasury Department, which used to engage in its drug enforcement programs in profiling particularly African-American women. And when he got rid of that program, the effectiveness of the searches and seizures and surveillance increased enormously.
Well, I'm aware of that demographic aspect because as an older person, I'm never stopped. They never look in my bag. But I see younger people, especially people with darker skin, stopped all the time.
Leonard, I hate to disabuse you of your sense of personal security, but, you know, it is interesting because the airport searches for those of us who fly are the most visible, obvious manifestation of increased government surveillance. But there are so many forms of government surveillance that are secret that you cannot know if you are being subject to
them. In an article last May in The New Yorker, Jane Mayer quoted a former NSA analyst, Bill Binney, as saying he believes that the NSA now stores copies of every email transmitted in America in case the government wants to retrieve the details later, and that it can be searched with dictionary selection in the manner of Google.
This is another example of a measure which is not only, as you say, a heretofore absolutely uncontemplated invasion of privacy. No, one amendment George Orwell contemplated in 1984, right? Big Brother is watching everything we do and saving and storing everything we do or say. But in addition to...
And we're making it easier by having smartphones. Because
exactly.
They can track us everywhere.
And we've facilitated that. And absolutely, the government, unbeknownst to most people, is getting access to our locational information every time we have our smartphones turned on. But I want to come back to the second part of the analysis, which is this, profligate collection and storage of data is as ineffective as it is a counter to our liberties. And many law enforcement and intelligence and counterterrorism experts have said, this is dysfunctional. The government is being buried with information that it doesn't have the opportunity to analyze. And the problem on 9/11, we now know for a certainty, was not that the government lacked power to collect communications, but it had insufficient resources to effectively analyze them and interpret them.
They had collected all the information, but hadn't put all the dots, connected all the dots, as they said.
And, there's a wonderful metaphor, which continues to be true. You don't make it easier to find a needle in a haystack by adding more hay to the stack. And our haystack has now, mushroomed into a hay mountain.
Nadine Strossen has returned to our show 10 years after the tragic events of 9/11 to talk about its impact on our civil liberties. She was the president of the American Civil Liberties Union at the time, still associated with the organization, but currently a professor of constitutional law at New York Law School. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Nadine Strossen, who teaches constitutional law at the New York Law School. And we're talking about civil liberties. Does the Bill of Rights apply to all of the things we're discussing?
Yes, it does. And I think what's so interesting about that, Leonard, is unlike the constitutions of other countries and unlike international human rights documents and treaties, the American Constitution, including the Bill of Rights, does not contain a general emergency exception or national security exception to the individual liberties that it guarantees. Indeed, the entire Constitution contains only one provision that allows the suspension of one single right in times of national security crisis, and that is the suspension clause for the writ of habeas corpus, which Congress hasn't exercised. So officially, our entire Constitution, with all of its rights, including habeas corpus, is still in effect. And I think it's really important to reflect on what it was that the framers, what they had lived through and were living through at the time they made that very courageous decision, to go back to the theme of courage to exercise our liberties and face the future. I mean, our country was struggling. It was still being attacked on the high seas and across the Canadian border. There were domestic insurrections. Now we're the world superpower. You know, to think that we would now fear that liberty can coexist with national security is really to turn our back on the fundamental commitment that was made by our framers in the Bill of Rights.
How has the conservative wing of the court addressed this? The strict constructionists who I would assume would be going back to the Bill of Rights for inspiration.
You know, and the ACLU has always been a nonpartisan organization because support for and violation of civil liberties cross all party and ideological lines, and you see that on the Supreme Court, you see that in Congress post 9/11, and sadly, you see it in the presidents as well, because both presidents have very severely violated civil liberties post 9/11. The Supreme Court, the very first decision that the court issued on 9/11 issues was a case in which the strongest pro-civil liberties opinion was written by that odd bedfellows team of Antonin Scalia, probably the court's most outspoken conservative, and John Paul Stevens, who was then the court's most outspoken liberal. And they jointly agreed that the president did not have the sole power that he claimed. He claimed that there shouldn't be any judicial review at all of his power to unilaterally decree anybody, including an American citizen, an enemy combatant. So on the whole, conservatives as well as liberals on the court, when they have reviewed violations post 9/11, have a pretty good record of striking them down.
I want to play a clip from that conversation we had 10 years ago in connection to this.
Some of the most conservative members of the current court are the ones who most deeply cherish individual privacy and imposing restrictions on government power to intrude on that privacy. For example, and this is very relevant to the new kinds of surveillance technology that you were alluding to earlier in our interview, Justice Antonin Scalia wrote a very pro-privacy opinion at the end of the court's last term in June, in which he struck down infrared imaging technology that allowed government agents to see what was going on inside the privacy of the home. And what he emphasized was the plain language of the Fourth Amendment, which imposes on the government a very heavy burden that the framers deliberately imposed. The government may intrude on our privacy, but only if it can show probable cause.
So that was before September 11th. That you were referring to a decision. Has he been consistent since?
I would say on the whole, yes, in terms of individual privacy, but where the real problem with judicial review post 9/11 is on issues of separation of powers. And Scalia and some, but not all of the court's conservatives, have been very willing to defer to executive power. I have to say that the court as a whole, including the so-called liberals on the court, have also been unduly deferential to executive power in this important respect, Leonard, that they have refused to exercise any judicial review at all of many post 9/11 abuses, saying that it simply is not an appropriate case for the courts, that recourse has to be through the elected branches of government. And so for many shocking abuses, including torture, extraordinary rendition, which is a euphemism for illegally kidnapping people and flying them to other countries where they're subjected to torture and incommunicado detention, for the warrantless spying programs that are being deployed against Americans in our international communications, the courts have over and over and over again said, we are not going to review these violations because of legal technicalities, procedural technicalities. So essentially what this has done is to create an executive immunity for not only government, but for collaborators with the government, the telephone companies that, broke all kinds of laws and internal company guidelines by massively turning over data about their customer communications.
Well, have any of these things been challenged in the court? The Patriot Act, for example, has all sorts of things like roving wiretap capability.
The ACLU and others have brought many challenges to various provisions in the Patriot Act and to other post 9/11 abuses. We have won some important victories, including a number of Supreme Court decisions that have struck down not only detention of enemy combatants, but also the military commission system. But we have lost more cases than we have won, and not on the merits, because courts have said, ultimately, this is not a case that we as a court can resolve. Let me take one example, and it's one example of the rampantly increased government secrecy post 9/11. The courts have blown up a doctrine called the state secret evidentiary privilege, which in its traditional classic form, like every evidentiary privilege, said if their particular piece of evidence is confidential, then the court has to try the case without using that piece of evidence. You know, the doctor-patient privilege, the lawyer-client privilege, and so forth. The courts post 9/11, at the instigation of both the Bush and Obama administrations, have completely distorted that doctrine to say, if a lawsuit might involve anything that the government says is secret, then the court should dismiss the lawsuit at the outset without even considering the completely public evidence on which it could proceed.
And the courts have respected that?
Yeah, the lower courts have been divided, but unfortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court has refused to review lower court decisions that have come out the wrong way, and most of them have come out the wrong way over dissents. And so that means, in effect, you're getting this double denial of judicial review, which in effect is a ratification of government secrecy and the government abuses that are being shielded by this inappropriate invocation of secrecy.
Should civil libertarians be surprised by President Obama's record so far? After all, as a senator, he voted for immunity for the telecom industry for its involvement in the Bush administration's warranties wiretapping program.
The President Obama has been disappointing if you contrast, even putting aside the example that you rightly point to before he was elected, but take a look at what he did at the very outset of his administration. Promised to shut down Guantanamo within a year, promised to reexamine the military commissions. I mean, a number of significant promises that have been broken. I do want to commend the president for outlawing torture unconditionally. That shouldn't have to be something noteworthy, but it is, in contrast to the prior administration. He did shut down the CIA black hole prisons. But on some other level, the disappointments and the respects in which the Obama administration has perpetuated some of the worst abuses of the Bush administration, all laid out in an ACLU report we issued last year called A New Normal. So, you know, going back to the point that once something is in place, it's very hard to overturn it. In another sense, we shouldn't be surprised, Leonard, because that has been the pattern of every single government official, every single president in every national security crisis to abuse and exceed powers. Abraham Lincoln, revered as he is, deservedly in many ways suspended the writ of habeas corpus. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a liberal hero, was responsible for the executive order interning Japanese Americans. Bill Clinton, you know, many people consider him a liberal Democrat, and yet he and his liberal Democratic Attorney General Janet Reno responded to what prior to 9/11 was the worst terrorist attack on U.S. soil, namely the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing, by doing very much what George Bush and his first Attorney General John Ashcroft did, by advocating an so-called anti-terrorism law. It was called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, that vastly increased government powers to invade the privacy of all of us, that targeted habeas corpus, that cut back on the rights of immigrants. And in fact, the relatively few provisions that that the ACLU and the ideologically diverse coalition kept out of the 1995 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, ADPA is the acronym, that was brought off the shelf, dusted off, and turned into the USA Patriot Act.
What about the terrorism trials? Can secret evidence be used in the prosecution of terrorism cases, even if the accused is a U.S. citizen?
You know, if we are talking about a criminal prosecution in this country, then fortunately the guarantees of the Bill of Rights are still in play, including the extremely important right to see the evidence against you, to confront your accusers, and to have an opportunity to respond to that evidence. In contrast, the military commission system that was put into place first by an executive order by George Bush in October 2001, revised somewhat but not nearly enough by the Obama administration, that military commission system has been decreed by the Supreme Court to be unconstitutional and to violate international law precisely because of the ability to use secret evidence. And although there have been some reforms in the system after the Supreme Court decision, unfortunately, not enough. And you now have a prospect of non-U.S. citizens being subject to even the death penalty based on evidence that was obtained in secret through torture. I mean, there couldn't be a more dramatic violation of the most fundamental principles. And it's only a strategic decision by Congress to limit that power to non-U.S. citizens. They could trot out the same national security rationales and apply it to citizens. You mentioned the drone attacks. Those have been leveled, the so-called targeted assassination program, we know has been leveled against at least one American citizen.
Now, we've been talking about how the government has responded, but this week NPR ran a report about how even Mall of America security guards are being used for counterterrorism surveillance and will often refer people they've detained to law enforcement. What's your reaction to this kind of public-private cooperation, and are you surprised that it's in Minneapolis, which isn't really all that likely a terrorist target unless people are angered by Garrison Keillor?
Happens to be my hometown, Leonard. You know, interestingly enough, terrorism experts, I've been on many panels with them post 9/11, say that they do imagine that a very desirable target for terrorists would be sort of a quintessential middle American place, because the purpose of terrorism is to strike terror into the hearts of all people in our country. So,
but they're stopping people who just take pictures or write in notebooks.
So, I mean, is it a likely target? Well, possibly, but again, come back. I hate to sound like a broken record. Are these measures that are named anti-terrorism measures actually effective? And I want to come back to one of the those 10 principles that this diverse coalition subscribed to 10 years ago, because unfortunately it has not been heeded. We should resist the temptation to enact proposals in the mistaken belief that anything that may be called anti-terrorist will necessarily provide greater security. And that terrific NPR piece about the Mall of America actually extensively quoted an anti-terrorism expert, Dale Watson, who used to run the counterterrorism program at the FBI. And he was making a mockery of this program at the Mall of America, saying it's such a waste of resources. You know, people were being targeted and interrogated and their files turned over to police. You know, they were interrogated in a basement room for hours for looking in a suspicious way, quote unquote, at a mall security officer, for taking notes, for taking photographs. And what's and we've seen this in New York, so it's not only in Minneapolis. The NYCLU successfully defended somebody who was treated as a terrorist merely for taking photographs of certain buildings.
Nadine Strossen, who 10 years ago was the president of the American Civil Liberties Union, now professor of constitutional law at New York Law School. Nadine, I hope we don't have to wait 10 more years to see you again on the show. Thank you so much for coming by today.
Thank you, and I hope next time it's a more positive report.